Hey, welcome to the Parallax Podcast. I'm Liz Brown. In celebration of Earth Day, today we're excited to bring you a conversation that I shared with local artist, photographer, and environmental activist Diane Burko. Diane works at the intersection of art, science, and the environment. As a painter, she has always been fascinated with landscapes as geological phenomena. Throughout her career, she has spent time researching and photographing a range of locations, from the Wissahickon Valley in Philadelphia to volcanoes in Alaska and Costa Rica. In 2006, that fascination with landscapes became a commitment to addressing consequential impacts of global warming. In the time since, she's traveled to locations like the Norwegian islands of Svalbard and the glaciers of Greenland to witness its effects firsthand. Most recently, her work has looked at coral bleaching and the effects of climate change on oceanic ecosystems. Diane and I sat down to discuss these realities, how she became so invested in the fight to confront climate change, and how she remains optimistic. Here's our conversation. You started your career as a landscape artist, but transitioned to becoming an environmental activist. Could you describe that journey for me?
I always was interested in these wide, geological, monumental kind of vistas. And I blame that on my Brooklyn heritage, okay? Because growing up in a city with lots of asphalt, you don't see open spaces. So I think that when I finally went out west, it was really mind-boggling to me. Of course, I had seen images, and I actually started painting mountains, snow-covered mountains, before I ever saw big snow-covered mountains. I mean, I saw the Catskills, but that was about it. So
that's where I grew up.
Oh, really? Yes, yeah. That's right, Buffalo. Yeah, well, I went to school also in Saratoga Springs. Yeah, so I mean, I knew green landscape and lakes and things, but you know, the Grand Canyon is...
It's like, much different than the Catskills. I lived in the Hudson Valley my whole life.
And
it wasn't until I flew over the Rocky Mountains, I think, when I really
saw
the size of
The
real mountains.
And the openness and the skies. But, you know, I did the typical art school, graduate school here at Penn, as a matter of fact. So I did everything, you know, the figure, the still life and all that stuff. And also my art training was in the early 70s. So, you know, that gives a context of what was going on in terms of abstraction was going and it was pop art and things like that. So, you know, where do you fit in as a young artist? For me, the landscape allowed me to be abstract while still being not that abstract. And it gave me a lot of agency. I was able to, you know, put the blue where I wanted to, make the sky as big or small, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, that was kind of the beginning. And fast forward 30 years to the 21st century. And, you know, there's a lot going on and a lot of it has to do with the environment. So I had an aha moment around 2006. Had an exhibition that a curator put together. It was traveling to many different institutions. And when it went to the Michener Art Museum up in Doylestown, she said the space was different and she wanted to include some more work. Now, this show was basically sort of fire and ice. It was about my 4 years worth of a volcano project plus Iceland, which was the last volcanic country I visited in this project. And she said, you know, you did these ice and snow paintings way before, didn't you? And I said, yeah. And she said, do you have any of those around? And we located a big one. It was maybe, I don't know, 6-7 feet by 9 feet, acrylic painting. And they put that in the show. And it was an image of the Grand Jorasse. It was, you know, mountains, French Alps. And I was giving one of those museum talks that artists do, going through the galleries. And being a woman, I'm able to do more than one thing at a time. So I'm certainly talking about the work, but I'm also thinking at the same time about that painting because the year was 2006, and that painting was done in 1976. So I'm saying, oh my God, that's 30 years ago. And of course, you think about your life and what's happened and centuries and all that stuff. But what also came to mind, this is the epiphany moment, is the question about the snow. Was that snow still on those mountains? Why did you think about that? Well, climate change. And climate change really was in the air at that moment in time because Al Gore's movie had just come out, you know, Inconvenient Truth. And also Elizabeth Colbert had just published her book, Notebooks on a Catastrophe. And I had been reading her essays in The New Yorker, but here was her book. And that was my turning point. That's when I kind of realized that, hey, I just can't be continuing to make beautiful paintings. People buy them. They're, you know, compelling, but they're not doing anything about the issue.
you've looked at this issue from a lot of different perspectives. You've done projects all around the world, and you call yourself an artist explorer. Could you describe what you mean by that?
If you asked me when I was in graduate school or, you know, before 2006, if I would be an explorer, I don't think I'd ever use that term. You know, I'm not risk averse, but I'm also not a skier or a diver or any of, you know, those outdoor super sports. But what started to happen is when I embarked on this new direction in my practice, I started doing it first by getting information, by learning about climate change, by reading about glaciology. And the first few years, I was basically using other people's images, other people's information, like repeat photography, recessional lines, Landsat images, those are satellite images of the Earth, comparing things. And that was sort of, you know, the main kind of focus and how I, you know, started regrouping and changing my work and having exhibitions. And around 2012 or so, even 2011, it occurred to me that, you know, I can't keep doing the same thing. I'm an artist and I'm someone who needs to be continually challenged visually. So these strategies that as I were using, I already understood. It was time to move on. And I realized, hey, I'm not out in the landscape anymore. I mean, I used to, you know, fly over not just the Grand Canyon. I live in Giverny. I did a residency in Bellagio. It was all about en plein air painting, about being there, photographing it, going back to the studio. So I realized I had to get out there. I had to bear witness. And I guess that's where the adventurer title came in, because I started traveling to glaciers. I got a grant to go to the ArcticCircle.org. That was the organization. And I went around Svalbard. It's an archipelago, and it's 400 miles north of Norway, 10 degrees below the pole.
I was about
to
say, it sounds real cold.
It's cold, but it's Arctic. It is within, it's really into the Arctic Circle. I mean, Iceland, not really. You know, they think of Iceland in the Arctic Circle. Only one tip of it is. Greenland, of course, is. So with this residency, I was with 26 other artists and scientists, and the plan was that you're on this small three-masted barkentine, and you're traveling around this archipelago. Well, most of my work up until then was aerial. That's sort of my chosen point of view, looking down, because it's more abstract. So I tried to figure out how could I continue that perspective, even though I'm going to be on a boat going around and it's all going to be horizontal. And I was able, through a lot of machinations and hard work, connect with the Norwegian Polar Institute, which allowed me to fly with them in their helicopter over some glaciers.
That sounds amazing.
It was incredible. And we went to Nyalazand together. Nyalazand is the northernmost research station in the world. And it was international. You had Italians, French, Chinese, Russians, all there studying Kronobriand Glacier for the most part. I was fortunate enough through an effort to connect with a glaciologist named Jack Kohler, who allowed me to join them on their helicopter rides as they were checking their instruments in September. In the spring, they set up all these different instruments, you know, weather, all different kinds of computer stuff. And a lot of that information they have to actually gather and check if everything's in place. And they do that in the fall. What we were doing is flying in the air, landing on this glacier between crevasses. We'd all go out, check everything, get back in the helicopter, and fly again. So we did this for 2 days. And the imagery I collected on my camera was amazing, but the experience was just priceless. I was standing on a glacier close to the North Pole.
What does that feel like?
Like nothing else I've ever done. Like I'm an adventurer.
And so goes the title.
Yeah, there you go. So one thing led to another. You know, once we did Svalbard, oh, I should mention, the year was 2013. My husband, who's a landscape architect and artist, actually applied for the grant as well. And we both were there. We were like
the first
married couple. But the thing that was so cool is just serendipitously, a collector friend of mine got in touch with us in the October of 2012, and said, hey, I know you're really into all this ice stuff, and I have an opportunity to go to Antarctica. My cousin is involved, and we can get really discounted rates. So in 2013, we actually did the South and the North. We went to Antarctica also.
That's amazing.
It was mind-boggling. you know, from never being on ice to doing this, being in a Zodiac and climbing onto these icebergs and being in the midst of them. It was quite something.
I find it to be really interesting, the work that you're doing. I want to talk a little bit about the Anthropocene.
Okay.
If you could explain what that means to the audience, that would be helpful too.
Sure. Well, it's a geological term. You know, you have the Pliocene, the Holocene, which is where we've been in terms of geological eras. And all the eras that scientists, geologists, archaeologists, all these guys and gals have tracked have to do with how nature has evolved. The Anthropocene is now, and the difference is it's no longer about how nature has evolved as much as it is about how nature is being impacted by humans, by us, by what we are doing to the environment, so that now the changes that we're seeing ecologically, environmentally, are no longer natural, but they're being impacted by industry, by fossil fuel, and of course, by CO2. Parts per million wasn't supposed to go above 350, and we're probably at 418 now. That, was recorded in the last PCC report. It's crucial. I mean, the next 10 years, they're going to impact the next 100.
Yeah, I don't think people think about the length of time that it takes to undo some of the things that we've been doing.
Some of it can't be undone.
Yeah.
I mean, it can. We can mitigate at this point in time, but, you know, that CO2's in the atmosphere, it's going to stay there for hundreds of years. So as we keep emitting more fossil fuel into the atmosphere, there's a problem. And, you know, sometimes it's good to step back and understand these terms. You know, what does it mean to have parts per million in the atmosphere? Well, there's a relationship that has nothing to do with politics or religion or any of those issues. It's science. It's like gravity is a real rule. So is the relationship between CO2 in the atmosphere and heat and the way the atmosphere is rising. They call it the greenhouse effect, global warming, all those terms. Those are real terms, and this is what's happening to our environment. That's why you have sea level rise, because all these icebergs that I've seen are coming off of glaciers, and they're melting, and the sea rise is rising. Thus, you have more flooding, and you have more storms. You say, well, storms, what's that about? Well, it's about more moisture in the atmosphere and the atmosphere being heated up, and they're more violent than ever before. But heat does the opposite too. It also dries out environments. And so you have forest fires like never before in America and the West, but look at Australia. Australia's burning as we speak. It's devastating.
Not enough people pay attention. I think a lot of young people are paying attention.
Young people do. Thank God for Greta and everyone with her and the Sunrise Movement. It's the only hope we have, although there are other people like me and who care, but we've messed things up.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting the way that you're telling this story in a very transdisciplinary way. Bridging art and science and politics of climate change is something really interesting, and that a lot of people don't see it often enough.
All our world, it all works together. I mean, what was it, you know, our great leader? You know, well, if we do something, what does it matter? Look what China's doing. Well, guess what? We are all part of the same planet. And when there's a storm, when there's a tsunami, it hits other areas. And more in Iceland, remember the eruption, what was in 2010? That smoke from that volcano traveled around the world. We all impact each other. We have to understand that, because the life of our planet, and you know what? As they always say, there is no plan B. There is no other planet at this point in time. What we do now affects everything.
How do you feel your work with scientists has impacted your perspectives?
They're my information fountain. What I love about connecting with scientists is how passionate they are about what they're doing and how focused they are. But you know, the other thing that's so cool is we kind of have a symbiotic relationship. They give me information and I give them agency by talking about what they do. They're busy in the lab. They're busy measuring ice pools in Greenland. They're doing their work. And I think it's up to artists, and not just me, but all kinds of artists, to take that information and share it. And I should just mention, you know, about scientists and talking about ice, but my work now is different. Now it's about the oceans.
You're looking at coral reefs, correct?
Yeah. Another, you know, canary in the coal mine with the bleaching of coral reefs. And, you know, it's funny, that's even harder concept scientifically to wrap your mind around, you know, in public discourse. What the heck is a coral reef, you know? Why does it matter? Guess what? There are only 1% of, you know, stuff in the ocean are coral reefs, maybe 2%, but they sustain 25% of life in the
oceans.
There's
a lot of life there. I'm really big into snorkeling. So.
Oh, are you? Oh, yeah. Great. Then you know what's down there. And another thing people don't realize is 71% or so of our globe is water. It's the oceans. So there's a lot going on in the oceans, not just about coral reefs, but coral reefs are just fascinating. And I've been really blessed with relationships with marine biologists in the last few years. I've been to the Hawaiian Marine, HDMI, Hawaii Center for Marine Biology. I can't remember the acronym, but these guys are working with confocal microscopes where they're actually able to see a polyp. You know, a polyp is part of it, up close and watch them. The thing that's so fascinating about it, coral, it's animal, plant, and mineral. So the polyp is the animal part. It's the thing that opens and closes. And the plant is the algae that it eats and gives it its energy. And it does that through photosynthesis. And then it extrudes calcium carbonate, which is sort of where how they live. I call them big apartment buildings and
condos.
There's
so many animals that live in the coral reefs.
Exactly. And then all these animals, all these fish and different one-cell animals, all diatoms, all of them, they all pass through there. They get filtered there. Turtles, everything you can think of. So it's crucial to our ecosystem, and it's being destroyed.
So what does bleaching of coral reef mean?
Remember, I was talking about the calcium carbonate. The calcium carbonate is where they live, and that's what they think of when you think of bleaching, this white stuff that you see, which looks very cool to look at. People collect it. But what happens is when the temperature in the ocean rises to a certain degree, or when there's too much acidification, the amoeba, the animal part, starts to die because that other symbiotic relationship going on between the plant and the animal no longer functions, it dies. And the only thing left is the calcium carbonate structures, the dried out, empty homes where these live things used to live. That's bleaching.
That's so unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know they've been disappearing for quite some time.
It's really crucial. I mean, think of the Great Barrier Reef, which I've, by the way, flown over and photographed.
How do you feel about collaborations between artists and scientists in regards to advancing innovation towards solutions for climate change?
I think it's great. I wish I was one of those artists. I think you're more like that in the work that you do with coding and all that stuff I don't understand. My collaboration is really communication. So I'm sort of the outreach kind of part of the scientific process. And there are many scientists, you know, who write NSF grants and, you know, call upon me to be part of the NSF grant. Why? Because in order to rationalize, explain, get the funding to do something that's very arcane in the general public's mind, if there's a component of public outreach, it helps. So that's kind of my collaborative function with science.
I mean, clearly you're doing work around politics and policy as well. In the face of increasingly conservative politics, especially here in the U.S., can COP, for those who don't know, the UN's 2019 Climate Change Conference.
COP, yeah.
Can that or global climate agreements like the Paris Accord produce impact in your point of view?
I hope so. Not when you have a leader like we do right now, but hopefully we can change that in 2020. It's just criminal to see America no longer in the lead, but being ignorant like Australia and some other right-wing constituencies, or like the Brazil guy who's burning down the Amazon forest. It's shameful. Again, as I said earlier, our world is one world, and if we don't start working together, it's going to disintegrate. It already is. I mean, here you have a leader who's worried about immigration. Doesn't he understand what climate is going to do? Climate refugees are on their way. Everyone's going to be a climate refugee below the equator, and we're doing nothing about that. We're not looking globally at this situation. I think COP25, all the COPs that have come before, are a way of bringing attention to that. But COP25 was a disaster. And I must say, I was actually in Santiago. I spent a month in Chile in October, visiting the Atacama Desert, Rapa Nui, Easter Island, doing, you know, public engagement, speaking at universities in Santiago. And one of the groups I've spoke to was a high school audience, and they were young people from all over the suburbs, or little towns, but they were all at this conference preparing for COP25, which is supposed to take place in Santiago. And I was like their keynote before they broke out for their meetings. And then kind of revolution happened, and they took COP25 out of Santiago and moved it to Madrid. So that was kind of a sad, you know, event, because here was young people like Greta being active.
What are your feelings on how young people are viewing the problems that we're facing? How do you see them taking charge of these solutions?
Well, I think they realize no one above them is doing that. And I think young people today are so much smarter and more aware. I guess some of that is certainly due to social media, although that has a destructive side to it as well. But I think young people are very aware, not all of them. And I think they know that if there's going to be change, if they're going to have a future, they have to participate.
I think that there's a big difference between seeing a problem and knowing a problem and actually doing something about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. But that's the next step.
Yeah.
And that's why I speak to young people and, you know, Atlantic Council people as well. And going back to Santiago, one of the audiences, one of the universities, there's this young woman who, you know, was sort of like saying, well, what can we do? What can we do? What do you say we should do? And I said, look, you know the problem. You must be engaged in civic activity. This is, again, one of the faults of our education system in the United States. I don't think no one knew what the Senate and the House did before the impeachment. We are a democracy, but, you know, as they kept quoting during the impeachment, if we can keep it. And youth has to understand. I mean, it's shameful that in the United States of America, we have such a low voter turnout.
Yeah.
People have risked their lives, walked miles and miles in South Africa to vote. And here people don't even do that.
I think it's interesting, too, with the impact that technology has had on young people and not enough people get out in general. The newer generation of people using technology are going to be more active in communities.
Sunrise Movement is a perfect example.
Are.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, I was on the youth march, you know, the climate march in Philly this year, and I go to all the climate marches that I can, New York or D.C. or Philly. And I found it very uplifting to see the intergenerational participation.
And there are a lot of people that go to that. I think I walked through the last one as well. It's always really interesting. I think more people should get involved in that. I didn't even know that that was a thing that existed.
Really?
No, I didn't even know until I stumbled upon it one
You're
day.
You're kidding.
When I was cutting through Center City. And I'm pretty big on protest and activism.
Yeah.
And anytime I see a march, I try to follow it
and see what's
happening.
Yeah.
And I think that more people should do that.
Look, there was the Women's March in 2016. I think we are, you know, slow politically compared to Europe, certainly compared to Santiago and Chile. But I think people are becoming more educated and they realize that it's up to them.
So thinking about people living here in Philadelphia and the people who are involved in things like that, how does the type of exploration that you're doing inform our reality here in the city? And what's your sense of its future, our city's future?
I actually think we have a pretty informed city. We have a sustainability officer. And actually, Philadelphia is a model when it comes to stormwater management.
Did you know that? Have a ton of stuff on that.
Yeah. I mean, that's really amazing. So we have a lot to be proud of. I did a show at the Swedish Historical Museum, of all places, in September. And one of the things I do now with any exhibition I'm asked to have is I don't do it unless the museum or the gallery or the university guarantee public programming around climate change and the environment. And so I did the same thing with this institution. I said, well, hey, you know, are you going to do programming? And they did. And we had a panel, and there was a SEPTA representative. There was the head of sustainability from the city. There was a lovely state environmental leader who spoke, and I spoke. You know, there was a good example of our city doing something, and the SEPTA person, I can't remember his name now, he talked about the electric buses that have just been launched and how more of that is happening. So a lot of people believe cities are really where the leadership has to be. It has to start, you know, as they say, you know, locally and build up. And I think that's quite true because most of the population now is living in the cities.
Very true. We can be
leaders. I mean, look, it's California.
Yeah. Is there anything that you've seen during your travels that you would like to see here in Philadelphia?
Well, I just loved the energy and the political awareness that I experienced in Chile. We were there for a week or so, and we literally left the day before all the demonstrations started. We flew out to Rapa Nui, Easter Island. And of course, we were shocked when we heard about this. We had like a grainy TV in our Airbnb, and we saw these protests. So we called and texted all our professor friends and climate friends and artist friends there, basically saying, what's going on? How are you? And what I found fascinating is that almost every person who responded kind of said the same thing. And they said, well, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. They were protesting about a 3-cent raise in the fare. You would think, what's that about? But what it was about is that that country is still operating under the same constitution as Pinochet. The pension system sucks. Education, it costs huge amounts of money to go to be educated. There are a lot of problems in that country. And that, in terms of South America, is seen as a really progressive, successful economy. Chile. And of course it is because it has all these natural resources, a lot of them owned by other countries. If you think about the mining industry, for instance. So political awareness, we got to have more of that.
The world is changing always, and I think the future looks bright. At least I'm a very optimistic person.
Me too. Otherwise, I wouldn't keep making my art.
Yeah.
No, I do have hope, and I have hope because I'm an artist. I believe in beauty. I believe in nature. I believe in the good that we can bring to everyone if we're all in it together.
If we're all in it together, yeah, is really what matters. And speaking of optimism, how do you think we move forward in finding optimism while accepting the fate of humans is linked to the fate of our planet and
yeah,
other species that inhabit it?
Oh, species. We haven't even gotten into extinction.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's a whole other topic. Well, you know, it's clear now. This is it. We can't go back. Okay. It is at 416. Or 17 or 18 parts per million. But we can mitigate. And you know what? America used to be the shining beacon on the hill. America used to, you know, go to the moon, you know, invent vaccines, start the internet. This is a country that still has some really good minds in it, if we don't kick them out because they're not the right color or from the right country. So we have the ability to figure out fossil fuel alternatives, green energy. We have it now. I mean, look what we've done in terms of solar panels, in terms of electric cars. If only we had the leadership to support research and development in this area. You know, it's like a war. We got a war going here. The war is about our planet. Can we save it? It will never be the same, but there's still a great deal to value and preserve. And actually, that brings to mind an incredible letter that Rebecca Solnit, you know the writer Rebecca Solnit? I really admire her writing. And she came out with this letter, which I recommend everyone, you know, find on the internet, which is a letter to young climate activists on the first day of 2020. And it's uplifting. I use it when I give lectures to different university students because there is a lot of despair out there, but there's also hope. And that's what her letter is about. There's still stuff we can do. There's still nature we can value, even though many extinctions have occurred. There's still stuff that we can preserve, like the bumblebee, for instance. We have to strive to be better.
Bees have been disappearing
for
quite some time, and a lot of people have no idea.
Yeah, well, they will when they don't have
ecosystem.
Any fruit to
yeah.
eat. That's when they'll have an idea.
Yeah, when the pollen stops moving
around.
Yeah,
when the pollen stops moving around, you ain't going to get those peaches anymore.
Yeah, you're done. And I think bananas have been disappearing for
a
while.
Yeah, yeah. That's why education is so crucial. Science education is so crucial. Most people don't even know where food comes from.
Yeah.
If you live in a city, they think it comes from, you know, Wawa.
Yeah, one of my favorite books that I read in college was actually Michael Pollan's Botany of Desire.
Yes.
And I thought it was really interesting how he talks about the stories of all these different types
sure.
of foods that we eat.
Sure.
Where they come from. And I think there's also the documentary as well on Netflix or somewhere.
Mm-hmm,
I've seen it.
Mm-hmm. No, he's a good writer.
That was something that really changed my perspective on a lot of things as far as food goes. And the history of tulips even and all of that as well.
Right.
I feel like there's just so much to learn in this world.
There is, but it's so much easier to know it and learn it now than it was last century. It's all at our fingertips. You know, when you read, what's great about the internet is, you know, I could be reading whatever, and if there's like a concept or something, I don't remember what that really means. I just click and I find out what it is. It's instant learning. You don't have to schlep to the library with cards or any of that stuff. There's so much information out there. All it takes is being exposed to it and curiosity. And, you know, babies are born with curiosity. It's kicked out of a lot of kids in their education. But we all are curious beings to start with. Yeah, I mean, what is creativity? It's just connecting dots in a different way. You know, sometimes when I talk to scientists and we have a public conversation, one of the things I like to point out, and they agree, is we're so similar, artists, scientists, because we're both curious. We both are connecting dots that don't necessarily look like they should go together. We both create by experiment and by accident. I mean, the greatest discoveries in science sometimes happen by accident.
A lot of the work that I do is around accessibility.
Yes.
And working with underrepresented people mm-hmm. in tech and startups mm-hmm. and innovation communities. Mm-hmm. And when I think about the work that you've done, and I think about this idea of looking at aerial views and physically being there to experience something, I immediately think of access to things like drone technology.
Oh, yeah, and, right.
And also virtual reality
yes.
and augmented reality
oh,
and how.
Yeah, VR, right, yeah.
Yeah, at this point, so many more people can experience that even if they don't,
they don't have to go there.
They don't have
yeah.
to go there. They don't need the financial resources
exactly.
to be able to have those experiences
yeah,
anymore.
Yeah, all you need is the internet.
Yeah, that's yeah, all
I mean,
you
it's
need.
Not the same
It's
thing,
still not the same as
But still,
going.
It's so much more than I had access to when I was growing up.
Yeah, I feel
Think
like
about
it's
it.
An inspirational thing. I mean, you see something and you want to go there.
Yes. Or you want to save it from disappearing.
Or you want to save it from disappearing, yeah. which is what we should all be doing.
Yes.
Speaking of getting other people involved in this kind of work, what would be your advice to somebody that wants to make a difference as far as the
well,
environment?
Well, you and I have both spoken about the same thing. Be active politically. Marching is important. Voting is more important. And voting at this point in time, pragmatically, we got to change what's happening in Washington. But I think demonstrating is so crucial. I mean, gun control, what those young people did in Florida were just so inspiring. Of course, it hasn't changed everything yet, but there are ways that we can all hook in. And it's individual. Putting yourself out there is crucial. And you can't be afraid of that because, you know, there are other people like you that will be part of your community, whatever community is that moves you. But being passive, sitting in your little room and just playing with your phone is not going to ensure a future.
It's not going to ensure a better future for you or your children.
Or your children or your family.
Children.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the list goes on and on.
Exactly.
And how can people learn more about your work?
Oh, I'm all over the internet. Just
yeah,
Google
well,
it.
Yeah, and you have a lot of work on your website as
well. Oh, yeah.
Well.
Yes, yes. Yeah, my website is sort of like a history. I have wonderful studio assistants who've really put my website together in a way that it has archives. There are videos of different talks I've given. And there's also a section of links that talks about climate change. So it's not just about me. You can learn about different organizations you can join, like 350.org or the Sunrise Movement, whatever turns you on. There's a lot out there to hook into to make you a more active participant in your future. And the future of the planet.
You said you're also being active on social media as well.
Oh, yeah.
You want
Instagram.
To share your handle?
What is? Oh, my name.
Your
Diane
name?
Burko.
There
right.
we go.
I guess that's my handle.
Find Diane.
Right, Diane Burko. Burko.
Thank you so much for sitting with me today.
And hey, it was a pleasure.
I think your work is amazing. I hope more people take a look at it.
Well, thank
you've
you.
Done so much. I can't wait to see what else you do.
Well, me too. Thanks again.
A special thanks to Christopher Heckler for editing today's episode, Killaman's Ego for our music, our producers, Helene Forian, Lee Nentwig, and Nicole Koltik. This project is made possible by support from the Excite Center, the Design Futures Lab, and a recording space at the Dornsife Center for Community Partnerships at Drexel University. Thanks so much for listening.